Hi there, everybody. Oma Fabs here. Today, I'm talking to a fabulous woman, Deshaun Daisel. And you're married now, ne? So your surname is Bester. You're married.
Now Deshaun Daisel Bester, and doesn't do me any favors. That's such a complex name.
No, Deshaun Daisel Bester. No, it's got a nice ring to it. So we're talking about women changing the game. Now, I mean, you, if you talk about changing the game, you certainly fit the bill. Now, I remember in 1996, I remember listening to this team up on Mount Everest. What an accomplishment. Now, for younger people like my grandchildren who are just constantly on social media, can you just explain to us why was it such a momentous occasion in 1996?
Oh, thank you so much, Oma Fabs. You know, that moment, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later, is a moment that changed my life. So number one, never has a South African team or any South African been to Mount Everest before. And number two, not only were we the first team to do so, we put the first South African on the top of Everest, we put our new democratic flag on the top of Everest. And unbeknownst to me at the time, black people were not mountain climbers. So I found myself to be a very rare thing. In the high mountains of the world. And of course, once you're on Everest, you get noticed. So people literally came up to me and would tell me that they had never seen a black, especially a black woman, trying to climb a big mountain. And there's never, at that stage, no one's tried to climb Everest before. So we didn't realize that we were busy breaking boundaries just by being the first team to go up Mount Everest.
Yeah, that is absolutely amazing. Wow. I mean, your mother must be very proud.
My mom is extremely proud, but I must tell you, it's my grandmother who got me interested in climbing mountains, especially Everest. It's a long story if you have the time, but it's because of the women in my family that Everest started to manifest in my life.
Like, because that is exactly what I wanted to ask you, because you don't just wake up one day as a little girl and you say, well, maybe you did, to say, okay, well, I'm going to climb the highest mountain in the world, and then I'm somehow going to climb all the mountains on all the other continents as well. So you say your gran inspired.
My grandmother was an ardent fan of the British royal family.
Okay.
And, of course, with her generation, it was Commonwealth. It was, you know, they didn't have Kardashians, I always say. So the thing that kept their stories going was talking about the royals and the war. And, of course, when Edmund Hillary got to the top of Everest in 1953, was within the same week that Elizabeth got coronated. She became queen that week.
Wow.
And for my grandmother's generation, that was the news.
Yes.
So I grew up with stories of Everest from a very, very young age. And thankfully, National Geographic would come out with a new series every 5 years of that commemorative year of Edmund Hillary and Tenzin Norgay getting to the summit of Everest. So every 5 years, I'd get this like fix, you know, of Everest stories and history and stuff. And because we spent so much time with my grandparents, she helped to keep that story alive. Now, I don't think she meant for me to climb the mountains, but I think it was just for her generation, like such a captivating time, that she repeated her stories often enough.
So how do you go from teacher to mountaineering? So did you just one day decide, okay, I'm not going to give up teaching? I'm sure you had to keep, I had to keep on teaching. You weren't paid to go up that mountain.
Yeah, I will just say this, that the inspiration started when I was a little kid. Okay, so that was in the 70s. I started school in 1977, and we all know the 70s and 80s were all state of emergency in South
yes.
Africa. And reality set in. I was always adventurous at heart, but I had to also look at my limitations eventually, because we couldn't not see that. The system was so set up to let a person like me, a woman from the township, see that I can only go that far in life, you know, not any further. So I think the dream kind of went into incubation for a while. So I became a school teacher, but I always had a sense of adventure. So I got into camping and hiking, and I remember there was a defining moment for me. We were hiking, I think it was the Fani Bota Trail, and we went through the Blider River Canyon. And I was right at the top of the gorge with my backpack on, and you know, it was way back in the early 90s. And I remember looking down into that gorge, and we'd been hiking for days now, and my feet were sore and blisters and all of that. And I remember saying to myself, this is fantastic. I mean, that view was just gobsmackingly beautiful. And I thought to myself, it's not enough. And there was a yearning in me to get something, to get into something that was riskier, higher, with ice maybe. And somehow the dream of climbing Everest was in an incubation phase, but it may have popped into the subconscious. I still to this day can't be assured that it was the conscious understanding of Everest that made me have that thought when I was standing at the top of the Blider River Canyon. But I then eventually went on a backpacking tour through Europe, you know, because the sense of adventure was just always there. And when I came back from that, I realized that, you know, I need to do more with my life. There was just something missing, and the adventurous things I had done opened up my understanding of how much I could accomplish in my life. But of course, by now, it's in the early 90s, South Africa's changing. We became a democracy when I was 24 years old, and I was a school teacher already. I actually happened to be an official at the first elections. I have an IEC picture with myself.
Patch
with,
to prove it.
Yeah, the patch, you know. So it was just that incredibly momentous time. And, you know, then the rugby guys came back when we won the Webb Ellis Trophy and we got the Africa Cup of Nations in soccer. So there was just this magic that was happening at the time. And South Africa was finally allowed to go into the world. We had Olympic status now. We could go and participate in the Olympics then. And so a lot of things were just opening up to us. And lo and behold, Ian Woodall decided that it's time South Africans make a bid on Mount Everest. And he was looking for a team to do so. So they'd already chosen the men at that stage. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know where to find the women. Because remember, historically, I was also not allowed to be a member of the Mountain Club of South Africa. And so it wasn't an option for me. And in fact, I didn't even know I could go into the Mountain Club at that stage. But because I had done all these adventurous things and I had represented my sport provincially, I was a volleyball player. It was just all things that added to my profile when I applied to be on the team. And then, of course, we had to go through a selection process. And through the selection, you know, we climbed Mount Meru, Kilimanjaro, and so on. Ian Woodall decided that I would be a good candidate to take to Mount Everest. So Kathy O'Dowd and myself were the only two women on that team.
We all know what happened when you went up there. Now, my question that I want to ask you is, because you went back in 2003, how do you persuade yourself to go back up there? Because, I mean, bad things happened.
You're quite right, Omar Fab. The 96 expedition was probably the most traumatic up until that stage that people have ever experienced, given Everest's history. And up to this day, it's actually the most documented season on Mount Everest. You know, if you compare it to the 1953 expedition, which was obviously the historical one, so that one has more airtime and so on. But the second most talked about season on Everest is the 1996 season when we were there for the first time. So it really was an unbelievable season on the mountain. It was a crazy, crazy time because we had so much trauma. We lost one of our team members on the mountain as well. And we just found ourselves in the midst of a lot of change, but also a lot of hope. Mm-hmm. And so intermittent the drama and the trauma of the 96 expedition, there was also this hope and this inspiration that we're actually there for a new democracy called South Africa, and that we have all this opportunity to make amazing things happen, you know. So we just gave it our best shot. We really didn't know how that season was going to turn out.
I'm getting goosebumps while I'm listening to you. It's just absolutely amazing. So I'm sure you have just learned a lot about yourself. I mean, what would you say to that young woman before setting out? Now that you know stuff, You know, what would you say to her? What have you learned about yourself?
I am glad that young woman wasn't listening to the naysayers.
Okay.
I'm glad that young woman wasn't listening to the dissenting voices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that young woman was listening to her inner self, because there were lots of people who told me, you can't do it, it's not possible.
Yes.
This, you know, people like us don't do that. Women don't do that. You know, the male to female ratio was 1 in 67 or thereabouts.
Wow.
When I started climbing 26 years ago, and now it's smaller, but there's still a very large male dominance. But it was so bad that we couldn't even get gear that is built for females.
Really?
You know, yeah, I mean, nowadays you can walk into Cape Union Mart and find a decent fleece that's made for women in design. Not, it's not just men's stuff that's made pink.
Okay.
So
it was really, yes. I mean, yeah, because there was no market for it, obviously.
There was no market. And if you did find it, it was overseas and it was incredibly expensive. So we found ourselves in those early days just, you know, wearing men's climbing gear. So I had a lot of oversized things because nothing came in my size.
Yes.
You know, it was just that kind of thing. And your down kit that was designed for how men go to the bathroom, I'll spare you the detail. But we had to, as women, find our way around that. Because there wasn't really, and also South Africa doesn't have a huge mountaineering history. I mean, we go back 20 years. We don't go back 100 years like people in the Alps, you know, or even longer than that. So just the culture, the mindset, the things that we needed to overcome in order to convince ourselves and the world and our societies, our neighborhoods, our communities that this kind of thing is possible for us.
Yes.
That was quite it took a while, let's put it that way.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't see myself doing it. Kudos to you for doing it. Oh, no, it looks very tiring. It looks exhausting. I'm sure you lose your sense of humor along the way. So how do you, all these lessons, because you've learned a lot of lessons, and I mean, you've been through them all. How do you apply this to your personal life?
Yeah, so you do learn a chunk of stuff. If you learn about your capabilities, you learn about your strengths, your weaknesses, you learn about your personality and what you're willing to put up with and not put up with.
Mm-hmm.
You also learn about your values and principles, you know, so things that you would say, because of that, I will, and because of that, I will not. And so there are places where one has to compromise, but it's always fed by what is my belief system? What do I value in this thing? What is the purpose of what I'm doing? And you're right. I mean, you lose your sense of humor when those existential questions come into play. And, you know, it really does form you as a human being. Climbers can really get into themselves a little bit, you know. So one of the things I learned about myself is that I don't necessarily want to belong to a climbing community. I love climbing, and through my climbing, I've inspired a lot of people. They come to me and say that. I'm not saying this as a brag, but I think I did open people's eyes to the fact that, yes, black people can do this, number one, but number two, also women in South Africa can do this. But I think, secondly, there's just that sense that if you belong to a specific community, that's all you get to talk about. You get into this little bubble, you know, and you see it with musicians, with doctors, with teachers, with anybody. And I particularly wanted to prove to myself, as a very normal, average human being, that I can have a normal, average life and still do extraordinary things. And so I really don't see myself as an exception. I'm not exceptional in any particular way, but I am pioneering. And I think because of my pioneering spirit, I managed to do a lot of things that then make people go, oh, you know, get a paradigm shift about that thing.
Okay. Now, you say that you are not exceptional. I'm very sorry to tell you, I think you are exceptional. I get the pioneering spirit, but yes, you are absolutely exceptional. I mean, how does your husband feel about all these mountaineering? does he have a desire to come along or not?
We both love the outdoors. We went on a 10K hike with our kids. Our kids are little, 11 and 8 at this stage, And, you know, so we do those kind of things, but he's not made for high altitude. My husband's the opposite of me. He's quite risk averse. And that's good because I need someone to balance me out. but fortunately we go back a long, long time, almost 30 years. So he met me before the climbing happened. We broke up. I went climbing. And 15 years went by, so he followed my entire climbing career in the media, as everyone did, I think. And when we finally got back together in our late 30s, it wasn't a surprise to him that he found this woman, because we'd known each other all that time anyway. We just had this kind of hiatus for 15 years.
You just had to go climb the highest mountain.
Yeah, just had to go up a couple of mountains, and you know. But anyway, we got married at the ripe old age of 39 and had our kids in our 40s. So when we got married, it was an understanding that the climbing is there, the mountains are there. It's built a career for me, and so I didn't have to do too much persuasion. Let's put it that way.
Well, first of all, I don't know what you do, because you certainly don't look as if you're in your 40s.
No, I would be 52 now. I turned 52 in April this year.
I'm gobsmacked. you literally look as if you're in your 30s. So maybe I don't have the engineering that does that.
No,
to you.
I appreciate that. I always say I have to do the timeline, because when I tell people I started school in 1977, you can just see that the calculators are clicking over.
Thank you.
And then I go, well, I turned 26 years on Mount Everest, you know.
No, you're looking amazing. But I get the idea that you're not done with Mount Everest. Are you going back sometime?
Yes, you know, in 2020, thanks for bringing that up, we were supposed to be the first all-female team from this continent. And we had done all our prep and we were on our way, and sponsorship was a bit hard to come by. But the point is, we were on our way to Everest. And then, of course, COVID happened. The mountains closed down, and I just came back to base camp in my own head, and you know, sort of having to recalibrate, focus on business and family. But you're quite right. I mean, I'm definitely not done with climbing, but I'm certainly not done with Mount Everest.
Certainly not. I mean, because it kind of feels like a failure if you like gear yourself up to go, and then this thing happens. So that with the science of change, I mean, you can learn from your failures. A failure does not necessarily mean that it's a total flop. You've got to learn from it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're definitely going again.
It's a chance to recalibrate. I like to think of it as a back to base camp moment. On Everest, you do a lot of turns back to base camp. So you go high up, then you come back down, and you go further up and come back down. And I think mountaineering teaches us that. It teaches us that you can always go back to the mountain if it's important to you, if it feels like there's impact and purpose in your pursuit. But come back down to base camp, refresh, recalibrate, recharge, figure out another way, and reset your sights on what you really wanted to accomplish. And you can see this with all the world's best sports people. And in fact, in mountaineering, it's the most humbling experience, because you'll come across people that have tried 5, 6, 7 times before they actually got to the summit. Every once in a while, there's that lucky person who gets the weather right and all the stars are aligned on their first attempt and they make it. But the truth of climbing and high altitude climbing is it does that. It teaches you that not making it to the summit is not necessarily failure, number one. And number two, you can always go back down to base camp, whether it's the physical base camp of the mountain or the base camp in your own psyche that says there's a chance for me to go back and recalibrate. So I think always as I'm not making my goal as a back to base camp moment. And I help my clients understand that, whether I'm coaching clients, I'm a business coach now as well, to understand that a strategy is only a strategy if you have a back to base camp moment, because nothing is linear. You always have to check in. What are our resources? What is the climate like? What is my health and my safety like at this stage? How's the rest of the team doing in relation to what we want to do? And it's in fact because of a back to base camp moment that the South African team finally got the flag to the summit of Mount Everest. We didn't make that decision while we were climbing.
Yes.
We had to sit down, reflect, ask ourselves some pertinent questions, and out of that decided we're going to try again, you know. And that was after the big trauma that happened in that season. So to answer a question you asked earlier, why would I be going back in 2003? I was invited back because we had we had an opportunity to put the first South African the first South African on the top of the 7th summit. And I was part of that team as well. So as you can see, there is this pioneering thing about me. And for me, of course, it's a goal to get to these summits, but it's nice to open the gateway as well to make people see that it's possible. Yeah, this is a worthy pursuit.
No, I mean, absolutely fantastic. So it is Women's Month, and we are talking to all the women out there who are watching this. So what is the message that you want to give to women as we sit here?
You know, I am very touched by a quote that I heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg say. She is now the sadly passed away American Supreme Court judge. And her answer was that women are meant to be where decisions are made. And the reason for that is that all decisions that are made impact us. Mm-hmm. And if we are not there to represent our view, then how do we get represented and how do we get the future generation represented? So I don't have this thing that certain places are just for men and certain places are just for women. I think full representation is that women are where all decisions are made, whether that decision is on a mountain or in a boardroom or in a sporting meet or in politics. I don't care, as long as women are there while the decisions are being made. And sadly, from a leadership perspective, when I look at some of the forums, the international forums where we're looking at now to see representation, women are still completely underrepresented in places where important decisions are made. So my message for our female audience is put yourself somewhere where decisions are made.
I'm going to do that. That sounds like a fantastic idea. I'm going to start with my husband. I'm going to tell him I got very good advice from Deshaun. I'm going to start wearing the pants from now on. I think I'm going to make a few important decisions in my house.
Oh, goodness. What have I just done? It's about being part of the decision, not to make all the decisions.
Okay.
It's quite a responsibility.
Okay. I misheard it a little bit on purpose. So, okay, it's part of the decision-making process. Okay, that makes sense. Hey, that makes for a happy marriage as well.
I think so.
Thank you so much for speaking to me, Deshaun. You're really inspirational. I don't see myself climbing that particular mountain. I may talk to my daughter and say, you know, why don't you give it a shot? And as you mentioned, it's also about climbing different kinds of mountains. We all have our mountain that we need to climb, and you have really inspired me. Thank you so much. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you. What a pleasure to have this chat, Omar Fab. All the best. Happy Women's Month.
Yes, you too.